he turned back, and he went back to Dickens and grabbed him, saying that he couldn't bear the cold that had arisen between the two of them.
The story went on to relate that Dickens was touched. And as a result, the anger and the jealousy that had existed apparently between the two just kind of melted away. Sir Thomas, I'm going to have to adjust here a little bit. Sir Thomas Martin later on wrote in his memoirs about that, noting that Thackeray died just a few days later. And he said, "The next time I saw Dickens, he was standing at the grave of his rival." You would like the mic on. Okay.
I'm not getting anything right this morning, am I? We are in Luke chapter 8. Sir Thomas Martin wrote in his memoirs, "The next time I saw Dickens, he was standing at the grave of his rival. He must have rejoiced, Martin Rod, I thought, that he had shaken hands so warmly a few days before." I thought that was a neat story to illustrate the fact that sometimes opportunity just is there and then it's gone. And if you don't take advantage of it at the moment that it presents itself, sometimes there's just nothing you can do about it later on. The Greeks had an interesting concept of opportunity. In fact, they had a god in their mythology whose name was Kairos, K-A-I-R-O-S. Kairos is a Greek word that means literally time. Chronos is another Greek word that means time. But Kairos means the opportune time, a special time that you have to kind of take advantage of. And the picture of this god was rather interesting. Kairos was the youngest immortal child of the gods, of the god Zeus in particular. And he's pictured, apparently, in ancient times as a very attractive youth with winged feet. And his hair was peculiar. It grew down over his eyebrows, but the back of his head was shaven with just a little bit of sprouting of hair. I'm not going to use any names. You'll just have to imagine it. But I really tried to find pictures of this god so you could visualize the concept. And since I couldn't find any, I've taken the liberty this morning of combing my locks down over my forehead so that you could get the total picture of how the Greeks viewed opportunity, which was another way of talking about this god. And I appreciate the patience of the elders with my unorthodox hairstyle this morning, but the Greeks pictured this god as a god that you could only grasp from the front. You couldn't grasp him from the rear. There was no hair back there to get a hold of. Aesop actually had this to say as he writes about these kinds of fables. He says, "Running swiftly, balancing on the razor's edge, bald but with a lock of hair on his forehead, he wears no clothes. If you grasp him from the front, you might be able to hold him. But once he has moved on, not even Jupiter or Zeus himself can pull him back. This is the symbol of tempus," which is the Latin word for time, "kairos," or opportunity, "the brief moment in which things are possible." Now, please understand, I'm not giving any credence to the Greek mythological system. I'm merely making the observation that their perception of opportunity was that it was something that had to be grasped at the right moment. Because once it's past you, there is no recovering it. And that's what I want to talk to you about this morning. I want to talk to you about a story of pigs. In Luke, the 8th chapter, as Jesus visited an area known as the Decapolis and interacted with some of the people in that area. Opportunity that is not seized in the present is often not available in the future. And that principle is probably no better illustrated than in the story of the Gadarenes. There are actually three accounts of this particular event. We're going to be looking primarily at Luke's account, But Matthew in chapter 8 and also the Gospel of Mark in chapter 5 record the same story. And I'll allude to some differences in those accounts in just a moment. But I want to suggest to you that we're going to talk about primarily the reaction of the Gadarenes to what Jesus did on this occasion. But ultimately, what I want to encourage you to do, and what I would hope we would all do, is seize the opportunities that we have. Take advantage of them now, and we'll say something about specific opportunities as we conclude our study in just a few moments. As I said, these three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all record the story of Jesus casting the demons out of this demoniac, this possessed man. And those demons entering a large number of swine or pigs, and those pigs then running down a hillside, a cliff, and being drowned in the Sea of Galilee. But there are some differences in the accounts of Matthew and Mark from the account with Luke. For instance, Matthew records that there were two demon-possessed men. Luke and Mark, in their accounts, only mention one man. And that's really bothered some folks, because at first blush they might just say, well, you know, this seems like a contradiction. How can there be one man but also be two men? One or the other is true. I think we need to make the observation that neither Luke nor Mark says there was only one man. They just talk about one man. Matthew provides us with additional information and indicates that there was another man. But Luke and Mark don't deny the existence of that second man. To illustrate the point, let me tell you about a man by the name of Edward Everett. Edward Everett, in the history of our country, was once known as perhaps the most polished orator in the entire country. He was at one time, I believe, either Secretary of State or Under Secretary of State, I don't recall which. But on one occasion in the 19th century, he delivered an oration that lasted for 2 hours. It was over 13,000 words. It was polished and presented in a way that it would be remembered from that point on in our history. Edward Everett. Do you know who I'm talking about? I'm talking about the guy who spoke at Gettysburg, but wasn't the president. Abraham Lincoln spoke and gave what we call the Gettysburg Address on November 19, 1863. His address was less than 300 words. Took about 2 to 3 minutes probably for him to present it. But you know what? You can go to a lot of histories and read about the Gettysburg Address, and you're going to have to hunt to find Edward Everett's name. There were two speakers. Lincoln was an afterthought by the fellow who arranged the commemoration of the dedication of the cemetery there at the Battle of Gettysburg. They were still burying bodies at the time that this Gettysburg Address was given. And yet in history, we only remember one speaker. And we remember the guy who had the short address, the one... If Mike Eisen was here this morning, he would say, Alan, you need to take note of this. The two-hour guy got forgotten, and it was the three-minute guy that got remembered. That's not the point of the illustration. Don't get lost here. The point is, we remember one of those guys because his speech was so significant, and we forget the other guy, who incidentally was intended to be the main feature of that particular ceremony. And here's my point. Luke and Mark mention one man because apparently he may have been the more fierce of the two. He may have been the more vocal of the two. He may have been the man with whom Jesus conversed. There's not a contradiction here. There's merely the observation that Luke emphasized, along with Mark, perhaps the more important detail, at least in his telling of that story. The other difference that I would point out to you is the name of the city or the area where Jesus went. And again, this causes some problems. I don't want to dwell on this very long, but I think it's worth noting, because people are frequently, and particularly in our modern culture, very anxious to point out things in the Scriptures and in the Gospels in particular, where they think there's some sort of contradiction. It makes Christians look bad. You know, we believe this book where there's a lot of errors. What we need to understand is that this event took place near the Sea of Galilee. We understand that because of the drowning of the swine. Mark and Luke said it took place in the country of the Gadarenes, or near the city of Gadara. Matthew, in the New King James Version, records it as Gergesa. Those are two different places. Now the question is, how can it be in both places? What we need to understand is that Gergesa and Gadara were in the same general area known as the Decapolis. Gadara was the town that essentially controlled a larger area there, or at least had influence over that area. Gergesa was the actual place where it took place. And that becomes a little more apparent here. Well, I don't know if this will work or not. Hey, it does. Here's Gergesa, and if you look at the topography here, you see that it's along the edge of the Sea of Galilee, whereas Gadara is way down to the south and to the east of the Sea of Galilee. One gospel account records the area of influence of one city. The other one merely observes exactly where it took place, that is, the area of Gergesa and the Sea of Galilee. The Decapolis, there's another map that shows you Gergesa up here, and then the Decapolis down on the bottom, and of course that's the area that we're talking about in general. Now, having said all that, I just wanted to bring out some things that would perhaps make it easier to understand that we're not dealing with contradiction in these stories, we're just dealing with different viewpoints or different emphases in the different accounts. But there are some other pertinent facts in this story. For instance, Jesus asked this Gadarene demoniac what his name was, and his response was Legion. That's an interesting thing. We understand from history that a legion of... I've missed my slide here. This is a photo, incidentally, of the area around the Sea of Galilee, this very area that we're talking about. It's a compliment of Olin and Jane Britnell, who have recently been gadding about the world and managed to take this photo and shared it with me. I want to talk to you, though, a little bit about Roman legions. A Roman legion would vary in strength depending on whether there were plenty of recruits and, of course, the time in which we're talking about. But generally, a Roman legion would vary between 4,000 and 6,000 individuals, people. And that's kind of an interesting fact because the man says, "My name is Legion." Why? Because there were lots of demons who inhabited him. We don't need to think of demons in a corporeal sense as though only so many will fit in a man or in a particular physical body. They're spiritual beings, apparently, and many of them were inhabiting this particular man, the other man, as Matthew notes. There seems to be some indication that demons seem to need or prefer to inhabit a physical body. When Jesus, it is clear, is going to cast out these demons, the demons plead with Jesus that he will permit them to inhabit the swine. They preferred the animal's body than to go into the abyss where apparently there is no corporeal host. I would encourage you to turn over to the Gospel of Matthew just briefly to a short story that Jesus told there to illustrate the point that evil needs to be replaced by good in a man's heart in order for that man to really change his life. That's the principle behind the story, but I want you to look at the way Jesus teaches that principle. This is in Matthew, the 12th chapter, beginning in verse 43. Listen to the text, New King James Version. "When an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places, seeking rest, and finds none." He's left his corporeal host, the man, and now he's looking for another host. He's looking for rest. He wants to be in a body. Then he says, "I will return to my house from which I came." And when he comes, he finds it empty, swept, and put in order. Then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits, more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. So shall it be with this wicked generation. There may be other things involved, but it seems to me what Jesus is saying here is it's not enough for a man simply to sweep out the evil. He's got to fill it with something else, or the vacuum will be filled with even things worse than that which he has swept out. But my point is, the story seems to imply that demons want to inhabit a body. And we see that again from the story in Luke chapter 8. But there's another point here. And that is that demons controlled their host. This man was a nightmare. He lived in the tombs. He went around without clothes. That may not mean necessarily that he was totally naked, but certainly he wasn't clothed according to modesty standards. He'd been shackled and chained by the inhabitants of the region from time to time. He would break the chains. He went in the mountains and in various places wailing and crying out, and people were afraid of him. They couldn't control him. What do you do with this madman? He was possessed by demons and they controlled his behavior. Notice the indication of their control in the conversation that Jesus has with them. In Luke the 8th chapter and in verse 31, Jesus asked him, the man under consideration by Luke, saying, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," because many demons had entered him. That's all singular. And they, the demons, begged him. Compare Mark's account. We're not going to do that for a reason of time, but jot down if you will, if you're taking notes, Mark the 5th chapter, verses 7 and 9, and note that it just kind of goes back and forth as to who's speaking, whether it's the man or whether it's the demons who are controlling the man and using his body or controlling his body. Notice the behavior of the swine, too, once the demons enter them. They do something which for swine seems to be rather irrational. They run down the slope and they go into the sea and they're drowned. But that's not where I want to go today. I'm not all that interested in talking about all of the fine points of demons. There's something strange about this story. John didn't read the whole story by my request. And so what I'd like to do now is finish the story. We're going to pick up in verse 34 of Luke the 8th chapter. So far what's happened is Jesus cast out the demons of the man or the men and they've gone into the swine. And verse 33 says they ran violently down the steep place into the lake, that'd be the Sea of Galilee, and drowned. Now verse 34, when those who fed them saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. Then they went out to see what had happened and came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had departed sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. Wow. What a change from the descriptions of Matthew, Mark, and Luke of his condition prior to this exorcism. And they were afraid. They also who had seen it told them by what means he had been demon possessed, who had been demon possessed, was healed. Then the whole multitude of the surrounding region of the Gadarenes asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. And he got into the boat and returned, went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. These demon-possessed men had posed a problem for these people. It wasn't safe to go where they were. They were uncontrollable. These were men who were not in their right minds. There are passages in Luke chapter 8, verse 29, that describe their behavior. Mark the 5th chapter, verses 3 through 4. Luke says it also in chapter 35, in verses 35 and and 37, that the people were afraid of Jesus, but they had been afraid of this man. Couldn't be controlled. But what's startling is the reaction of the Gadarenes. Jesus has solved their problem. He has removed this tremendous menace to that area. He has healed this man in the sense of casting out the demons. Life is good. Why in the world would you ask Jesus to leave? Does that make sense? And that's what interests me about this story. Well, the exorcism is impressive. And the mental picture of 2,000 hogs catapulting over the side of a cliff and into the sea and drowning, their bodies floating in the water, is pretty vivid. I hope I've prepared you for lunch. But I'll tell you what strikes me about this story is why the people of Gadara acted the way that they did. Why were these people afraid? Well, there's something interesting about this. I wonder if they were afraid of the great power that Jesus possessed. You know, in the past, they'd been impressed probably or afraid of the demon-possessed men. And now somebody comes who's even more powerful. Maybe that was the reason they were afraid. Some have suggested that they were afraid maybe Jesus, if he stuck around, was going to destroy more of their property. 2,000 pigs is a pretty big loss in anybody's economy. Note the language that is used by Matthew over in the 8th chapter of Matthew and in verse 33. Matthew chapter 8 and verse 33. There's a peculiar way of expressing what happened here that Matthew uses. This is verse 33 of Matthew 8. Then those who kept them, that is the swine, fled, and they went away into the city and told everything, including what had happened to the demon-possessed men. Wait a second. Wouldn't everything include the demon-possessed men? I mean, when you've told everything, wouldn't you have told about that? I mean, wasn't that the most significant thing that had happened, that these men who are wild men and couldn't be controlled, that the demons have been exorcised and now they're okay? Wouldn't you have to... You get the impression that maybe that was the secondary thing? That what really was important to them is, we lost everything today. 2,000 swine into the sea, dead, it's all gone. And I wonder if that particular way of saying it, and Mark's language in verse 16 of Mark 5 is kind of similar. 2,000 swine had been killed. Now others would suggest that perhaps they were afraid of the consequences of keeping swine. You know, if you were a Jew, you were not to be having contact with swine. It's not just that you couldn't eat swine's flesh. That was unclean under the law of Moses. But you weren't to have contact with them. You weren't to even be touching them. They were unclean. Now, some would argue, well, this is the Decapolis. The Decapolis was an area in which Gentiles were very numerous. But there were Jews in the Decapolis also. I've held that view in the past. I'm just not so sure that that's sustainable. That what they were concerned about is the consequences as Jews of keeping animals that, according to Leviticus 11, were unclean. And so they asked Jesus to leave. Whatever the reason for their fear, and I want you to understand, I'm not sure that's important. Whatever the reason for their fear, this is what is important. They lost a tremendous opportunity because they asked the Savior to leave. They asked the Son of God to depart from their region, and not just one or two of them. A whole multitude. The town came out and said, will you please leave? And I'll tell you the saddest part of this statement, this story rather. That's the statement of Luke. And he got into the boat and departed from there. No reasoning, no argument, no discussion. They asked him to leave and Jesus left. What a tremendous opportunity they gave up. But I'll tell you, people are doing the same thing today. And I sometimes wonder if it's because they've got pigs in their lives. Whether it's a matter for these swine keepers that they were unclean animals and they're afraid of the consequences, or whether it was just a matter of losing that much money and them being afraid of maybe losing other things. Whatever the reason, it seems to have focused on the fact that the pigs died. Because everything else that I can find in that story was good. And I think there are a lot of us who've got pigs in our lives today. There are some people Perhaps no one here, but there are some people who will reject Jesus because of money. You want to hear something that's just absolutely ridiculous? I have actually heard of people who will not become Christians because all the church is interested in is money. And what that tells me is that all that person's interested in is money. Think about it. You won't become a Christian, you wouldn't pursue salvation because you don't want someone to get any of your money. That's a herd of pigs that somebody's clinging to. And then, of course, there are others who are too busy making money to fulfill their responsibilities as Christians or perhaps to become Christians in the first place. And then there are others who are just so enamored of their pleasures, their lifestyle, they can't give that up for Jesus Christ. So they ask Him to leave. They reject Him because of the pigs in their lives. We talked about that a little bit last week when we talked about worldliness. And then there are some others who will reject Jesus because in their life, what's more important is that people around them accept them, and they know that once they become a Christian, they're going to be out of the group that they have been used to being a part of. It may be their family. There are people who will not obey the gospel because the rest of the family has different religious views, and they don't want to be ostracized from their family, or perhaps they don't want their family to think that they're making some sort of statement about their beliefs. And so they will look truth in the eye and tell Jesus to go. Because what's more important to them are the pigs. Something in their life they can't give up. In this case, family or peers. There are others who reject Jesus because they're afraid. Like these people were said to be afraid of Jesus. Some of them are afraid of the commitment that a Christian needs to make. Studied with a guy in Brazil one time, just the most pleasant guy, seemed so interested, and we studied for several hours in a little town over in the west side of São Paulo State. Studied for hours, and I really thought we were making some progress. He seemed to understand the arguments I was making in broken Portuguese, and he seemed to be agreeing with the points. And when we got to the end, he said, yeah, but you know what? I've got this problem and this problem and this problem in my life. And I just don't know that I can give those up if I become a Christian. So I'm going to wait until I give those up and then I'll become a Christian. You ever know anybody like that? Afraid they can't do it perfectly, so they never get started. And so they tell Jesus, just wait, I'll get back with you. They're afraid that they'll not be able to live a holy life before God. A perfect life. And yet that's not what God demands. He demands the best that we can offer, but understands that even our best is inadequate. And that's why the Scriptures talk about us as being saved by grace, by God's favor. Now I want you to contrast the attitude of these people who said to Jesus, we just want you to leave, with the attitude of the men who were freed from demon possession. Let's go back to Luke again, to the 8th chapter of Luke, and this time we're going to be looking specifically at verse 39. Verse 38, let's begin there. Now the man from whom the demons had departed begged him, that would be Jesus, that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away saying, return to your own house and tell what great things God has done for you. And he went his way and proclaimed throughout the whole city what great things Jesus had done for him. What a contrast. The people of the city who were in their right minds prior, supposedly, are asking Jesus to leave. They're afraid of him. And the man who had been irrational in the past is begging Jesus to go with him. Now something interesting happens here because Jesus doesn't permit that. Jesus says, I want you to stay here. And I want you to tell everybody about what's happened to you. I'll tell you why that's startling. Because on numerous occasions, Jesus healed people and said, don't tell anybody. Don't spread it around. I think the reason for that may have been that there were times when Jesus was mobbed by crowds and was unable to do the work or was impeded in the work that he needed to do because of the size of the crowds. But not in Gadara. Not in the Decapolis. Here, they didn't want him there. This guy, the demon-possessed man, who's now been freed, he's an excellent example of personal evangelism. That's exactly what personal evangelism is. Go tell everybody you know that you meet what God has done for you. Isn't that what we're all about? As we talk to people about the gospel, we want them to have what we have, what we enjoy from God. It may be that the people of this city, this area, could only see what they had lost or perhaps stood to lose rather than what they might gain. And that's important. You see, if our perspective is we look at Christianity, we look at the opportunities in our lives and we only see what we're giving up instead of what we're gaining, we may just end up like these people, asking Jesus to leave in a figurative sense from our lives. They'd only could see what they'd lost rather than the opportunity which Jesus' presence apparently afforded them. I'll tell you what. Every day is filled with opportunity. As long as you and I draw breath, we have opportunities. Opportunities to teach, opportunities to do good, opportunities to obey, opportunities to serve God. Our lives are full of them. We don't need to keep looking for them as though they're elusive quarry. They're all around us. Opportunities to help bring others to spiritual blessings in Christ. I think the details concerning the demon possession are interesting, particularly in light of the modern day obsession with possession. But the behavior of the Gadarenes is just beyond amazing. It is sad. Jesus will not force himself on us. Opportunities abound, but we have to decide whether we'll take advantage of them or not. If you ask him to leave, he will leave. Of course, we'll all see him again, literally, on the day of judgment. And then he may ask us to leave. There's a song in our book, it's song number 305. It's not the invitation song, but it could have been. It's a song we all recognize, it's the song, Let Him In. And in the verses, the song speaks of inviting Jesus into our hearts. Here's what verse 2 says. It's on screen. Open now to him your heart. Let him in. If you wait, he will depart. The Gadarenes beg Jesus to leave. And the question to you this morning is, what will you do with Jesus? Will you open your heart, as the song suggests, and let him in? And by that I simply mean, will you respond to the offer of salvation that he makes to all men? Through the death on the cross, the price for sin was paid. And you and I can be sons of God, heirs with Jesus Christ, because of the grace of God that was manifested in that sacrificial death. I appreciated Noble's comments very much this morning. Lord's table. Or you can shut your heart. You can keep the pigs. Or whatever it is that's more important. But I'll tell you, the sad thing is Jesus will not force his way into your heart or mine. You're going to have to open it for him. You're going to have to invite him in. Otherwise, opportunity may pass you by. I hope and pray you have more opportunity. But I want to tell you something about opportunity. And particularly opportunity to do right. To do what we know we should do. There's danger in delaying that. Because what happens is the motivation to do what we know we should becomes less and less, often just with the passage of time. It's hard to put it off in the beginning, and then it gets easier because we become accustomed to saying, well, I'll do it later. We procrastinate. And I'll tell you, the saddest part is when people lose that opportunity forever. Don't let that happen to you. This morning, if you need to confess your faith in Jesus Christ, if you believe that with all your heart, that He's the Son of God, the risen Savior, then you need to confess Him this morning. Don't let this opportunity pass you by. If you'll confess your faith, having repented of your sins, we'll immerse you this morning. We're not going to wait for a month until we get up a group and go down to the river. We'll immerse you immediately, same hour of the morning, for the remission of your sins. It's that important. And we want to encourage you to do that now as we stand and sing. If you'll come to the front, we'll assist you.